purpose for us all collectively just has to be to create a world in which we can live sustainably within the resources that the planet can provide, because otherwise there isn't really anything else.
So welcome to Green Planet, Blue Planet podcast. Today I'm here with Kat Bruce, the founder of Nature Metrics. And welcome to the show, Kat.
Hi, thanks.
It's great to have you. It's great to be with you. You're in Geneva today, living the busy life of conferences to make waves and get Nature Metrics connected to the right stakeholders in policymaking and politics and industries to bring nature conservation and biodiversity protection into the real world. How did that all start for you? Like, where's your passion in that kind of business that made you start this about, I think, like 2016, if that's right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, I started the company in 2015. And for me, I never, ever expected to be doing this. I absolutely never sort of set out thinking I want to be run a nature technology business. There wasn't even such a thing as a nature technology business when I started Nature Metrics. And I remember the first time I sort of went out and pitched to investors and said, we're going to transform the scale at which we can measure and monitor biodiversity. And I got some really strange looks. And they were like, well, who's going to pay to know about nature? It's not important enough to anybody. And that was only 2015, not that long ago. So it's been amazing over that time to watch the world sort of wake up and realize that nature is important enough to invest in. But for me, strangely, actually, I studied no sciences at school. I originally went to university to study Latin and Greek. So I was a classic student at Oxford, sort of had a bit of a moment when I thought, actually classics is almost by definition not the future, dropped out of university, didn't know what to do with myself, and just joined the furthest away expedition that I could find to just sort of go, just go as far away as I could, and sort of found myself accidentally in the middle of the Ecuadorian Amazon. Living with an indigenous community about 100 miles away from the nearest road, with no running water, no electricity,
That will do it.
Yeah, it does, right? I mean, it completely changes your life. I don't know how. Either you spend 3 months in that situation and you cannot wait to get out, you don't look at your life in the same way again. And that was definitely...
Well, probably both, right? at some point it's like, wow, this was quite enough. But then it does have this effect to get in touch with, original people and especially the Amazon, and just seeing like, wow, this planet is so beautiful and so worth protecting.
Yeah, I mean, that level of richness and diversity, it's very, very difficult to describe or to get your head around without experiencing it. And I think, I guess I hadn't thought very deeply about it before because it was all a bit accidental. But actually for me, strangely, I discovered this amazing transferable skill, which was that because I'd spent so much time learning ancient Greek verse, which I'd had to learn by sound, pages and pages of it, it translated really well into learning bird calls in the Amazon because I was just really tuned in to learning sounds. And so I got really, I could identify about 150 birds by their calls at the end of a couple of months.
That's a very cool skill to have.
It is.
And it makes me think, people who don't live in a technology reality or the modern day era, like that might be their everyday life of knowing hundreds and hundreds of bird calls and, animals and sounds of leaves kind of by heart. Right?
Oh, yeah. You watch the indigenous communities there. I mean, however good we got at doing that, we were, less than 1% of their skill and knowledge. You'd walk through the forest and they would see things, so far away that you would then spend 5 or 10 minutes looking through your binoculars at that exact spot that they were pointing to. And eventually you would see sort of one tiny part of a bird and they'd just walk through and gone, oh, that's over there. Just completely incredible.
Wow. I love that kind of backdrop to, what you're doing with Nature Metrics now, because it makes me feel like, you know, the reality of nature almost like talking to us at, in these special places like the Amazon, where biodiversity is maybe normal, yeah. maybe the way it's supposed to be, you know, to talk to us to say, hey, look, like, don't let this go to waste. Let's really understand how to bring this to the modern world, right?
And absolutely. So, and I think the context that we were there for was really, really interesting, because it was an indigenous reserve where they knew they had oil underneath. And the reason they wanted the biodiversity surveys to be done was so that they could get some protection on the reserve. And give themselves some protection against exploitation for the oil that was underneath. And in Ecuador, they'd had 30 years of seeing what had been happening further north in the same country through the sort of oil exploration and the way that the communities had just been, you know, completely devastated, and had lost the forest and had lost, therefore, you know, everything that made their lives and their ways of lives livable. And so they were so motivated to use the science to be able to tell a story to policymakers, to be able to get themselves those protections on the land. And they're potentially also looking at starting ecotourism as well, to be able to bring in some revenues on their own terms. So, you know, for me, it's never been just about the biodiversity. It's been about the links between biodiversity and people and sustainable livelihoods, and a recognition that, you know, we've got to find ways to create a world in which all of these things are possible, and the way that we've been living and exploiting the planet is not a world in which they are all possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Have you been back to the Amazon since then, or has it been just like nature metrics creating those science based data points to convince policymakers? Like, yeah. tell us more about your story. I find so this super exciting.
So I ended up spending, after that, I basically decided I was going to spend my life running around the Amazon counting birds, because I was good at it and I liked it. And so I spent a couple of years going back and forth to the Amazon and doing a few expeditions. So I built balsawood rafts and floated down one of the tributaries of the Amazon for a few weeks, also going past one of the natural gas projects. So it was really interesting to just sort of see the effects on the communities and the forest as we went along. I worked in some research stations. I did sort of various trips. And then somebody at some point said that I should probably go and get a degree of some kind, because I might regret it later on if I didn't. So I went back to university really just to get, I went to do a wildlife biology degree, really with the intention of just ticking some boxes so I could go back and carry on hanging out in the Amazon. But I'm a bit competitive, and once I start doing things, I like to take them all the way through to their conclusion. So the undergrad turned into a master's, turned into a PhD, all of which involved some link to the Amazon. So I took an expedition out during my undergrad to the Ecuadorian cloud forest. And then my PhD originally was looking at modeling a particular system of ant plants in the Amazon. So you have these plants that live symbiotically with ants. So the plants grow little swellings, and the ants live in the swellings, and the ants protect the tree from predators. So I spent several months collecting ants in the Amazon. And then at some point during the PhD, I brought all the ants back and sort of sat in a lab for 18 months pipetting tiny amounts of colourless liquid into other tiny amounts of colourless liquid to do DNA analysis. And actually, I'm terrible at it. I've never been good at DNA analysis. I love what it can do, but I'm not the right person. I'm way too clumsy. And I had no confidence that these results were going to show anything interesting. And when I sat and thought about it, I was like, really, who cares how far these ants move and how we model this one system? Like, what does it actually mean in the big scheme of things? And at the same time, I'd been turning around the university rowing club. And I discovered what I loved was having a goal and building a team and trying to pull together all of the pieces that were needed to sort of build performance. And I thought that's much more like the business world than it is the academic world. So I tried to quit my PhD halfway through, and my supervisor said, hold on, he was like, I'm bored of the ants too. But there's this thing you can do now where you can take whole insect trap samples. So, you know, you can set up a trap and get thousands of insects that fly into it and are caught. Identifying the insects, turning them into data means, you know, it might take a year of someone looking through each individual insect under a microscope. But he was like, there's this thing you can do now where you can take a whole trap sample and you can put it in a food blender, and then you can just sequence the hell out of it with its DNA, and you can get a profile of everything that was in there, like, you know, within a matter of a few weeks. You can do hundreds of these samples. And he was like, I think it's going to be the future of environmental monitoring. So if what you really want to do is set up a business, how about, like, forget all of this other stuff we've been doing? Why don't we try grinding up some insects and seeing if that data is useful to anybody? So that was really the start of Nature Metrics.
Right. That's like the stepping stone that made you build Nature Metrics. And, you know, I find it fascinating because very few people, I think, go from, loving nature and understanding like their interconnectedness in that space or seeing the symbiosis between different species to then saying, how can I actually verify and measure this in a way that serves policymakers and industries so that we can make much smarter decisions, which, you know, I mean, let's be real. I mean, ideally, those smarter decisions would just be apparent to all of us that, you know, a tree that's not accounted for in a spreadsheet still has much more value than what it's accounted for in the spreadsheet. But that's not entirely the reality we live in, in the West or in our globalized world. And so those influences that people like you are bringing into this kind of world, they're pivotal, right? They're pivotal to create a healthy planet. And so that's fascinating because, you know, if you didn't get bored by counting ants, you probably would have not found that next step of DNA sequencing that now allows you to verify and measure in a way that actually is conducive to protection and environmental kind of conservation.
I tend to do things because I get frustrated that nobody else has. So I never really look for leadership roles. I just feel like something ought to be done. And I sort of look around waiting for someone to do it. And I'm like, oh gosh, well, if no one's going to do it, come on, then I'll go and do it.
No one's done it yet.
So I was, you know, we were sitting in the research world and I was writing up my PhD. And it was actually while writing up the PhD and looking at all of the background literature on measurement of biodiversity and on the indicators that are used, and you would read time and time again that such and such was a really good indicator, like, you know, farmland birds, or, you know, usually birds because people like measuring birds, and so everyone just, oh, they're a great indicator. And I said, okay, let's try and trace this back. Where's the evidence base? Who first they showed that birds indicated something? And you would trace it all the way back, and it would go back to some really obscure bird journal sometime in the 1960s when somebody had just said it. There was no evidence base behind most of what was being used. And it meant that there was, you know, there was always this, and there still is this ideal. If you want to make a change in the environment, you do something called adaptive management. So you see, you know, you take a hypothesis about how you're going to change your activity or how you're going to manage the land on the basis that it should deliver some sort of outcome. And then you measure it and you test it. And if it doesn't deliver the outcome, you adapt it so that you can, you know, you don't go for decades before you realize that you're not doing the right thing. The reality is no one's been able to do that because we haven't been able to generate that data on an ongoing basis to be able to really test whether things are working. So we've poured, I mean, even before the biodiversity world sort of really took off in the last few years, there was so much money going into conservation and environmental management that, you know, a lot of the time wasn't doing what it should have done because we didn't have the evidence base to be able to test and adapt and optimize what was being done. So it was really a sort of frustration and just realizing how little data there was and that we had something sitting here that really genuinely, I mean, was a step change in the scale at which this could be done. And we just thought, well, this can't sit around in universities for the next 15 years until someone decides that it might be worth applying. So let's take the step of taking it outside of the university space and setting up a company. But yeah, like I said, biodiversity was not a hot topic in the tech investment world at that time.
Right, because they're paradoxically kind of almost at first glance disconnected, right? Is the idea that everything becomes more linear, more straight line, more simple, more zero and one. And then biodiversity is kind of the opposite, where it's such a complex mega set of data in a certain way of looking at it that it's too much for our human mind to understand.
Well, but that makes it perfect.
Maybe unless we do grow up in the Amazon and we understand.
Yeah, but in a way that makes it perfect for the tech world, right? Because it's your classic big data problem. Like I find this real disconnect between people going, biodiversity is just too complex. We can't do anything about it. So we shouldn't bother trying to measure it. And yet we use big data to deal and AI and machine learning to deal with vast, noisy, complex data sets in like every element of our lives these days. So complexity of data isn't a problem. We've got tools that can deal with that. The challenge has been, how do you take nature and turn it into data at scales that are big enough to apply those sorts of analytical tools? So that's really where I felt like NatureMetrics, the sort of first stage of NatureMetrics was turn nature into data, and sort of build the confidence and the trust. Yeah, there was a lot of education to be done. Biodiversity monitoring is not a space that's used to disruption. It's not used to innovation and new tools. And so there's a lot of caution around adopting new tools. So there was a lot of just working with our customers, doing side-by-side trials, like building that confidence and everything. And then once you can start generating the data at scales, then it becomes really fun because you can start bringing in all of the sort of big data analytics and the AI and things to really sort of look at how we can tell the stories of biodiversity in a very different way.
Exactly. And that story of biodiversity, you know, I think in a again almost paradoxically seeming way at first is actually part of the benevolent future of AI, right? So if we think of AI in a way where these tools are, you know, they have a shadow and a light side to them, that light side is that benevolent future where we understand the planet Earth and ourselves, maybe increasingly so because of sets of data and how to, you know, have complex big sets of data that allow us to kind of maybe hopefully transcend this very linear zero and one thinking, you know?
Yeah, I
want to jump forward into today, Kat, with you, because I know that, you know, we just talked about the Amazon and like the origin of NatureMetrics, but you also mentioned it, like your other passion is in rowing, and you're part of, you know, like the sea change, the great, the row challenge that's happening in the summer. And I'd love to hear about that. And, you know, you basically continuing to be on expedition to take nature samples, but this time around Great Britain.
Yeah, I spent 5 or 6 years of my life just building a startup and building a company, and you get pretty sort of myopic about it, and you realize that a lot of the other bits of you that made you have sort of fallen away, even though at the beginning I did get to go out and do some sampling with some of our clients who were working in interesting places, but that sort of had happened less and less. I'd always rowed competitively. I love that. I love the sort of team nature of rowing. So I'd always rowed. I'd always done expeditions. And then my life was mostly around eDNA. So some point in end of 2021, actually, it was a guy who just started working for us in our marine team. And he came and he said, "Kat, I've got this thing. I've got to go and talk to the GB rowing team about eDNA." And I thought that sounded a bit strange, but he went along. Anyway, it turned out it was something called GB Row Challenge, which is this initiative to row around Great Britain in boats that have been modified to collect environmental data. So they already had microplastic sampling and sound recording on the boats, along with temperature and salinity. And they decided they wanted to add eDNA in as well so that they could get biodiversity data. And I think they basically wanted just a cheap price from us. And my colleague said, "Oh, well, you have to get Kat excited about that. And she'll probably give you a discount because she loves rowing." And they said, "Oh, why doesn't she just come in the boat then?" So he gave me a call and he was like, "Please don't fire me, but I might have just signed you up for something. You've got to talk to this guy called Will." So somehow I found myself last summer in a boat, which was me and five really enormous men rowing around Great Britain and collecting data. And it was amazing. And you set off from central London and go down the Thames, turn right when you get to the sea, and go all the way around Great Britain. It's about 3,000 kilometres. There's always bad weather because it's Great Britain. You're rowing all the time, 24/7, or 2-hour shifts, 2 hours on, 2 hours off, 24 hours a day for about a month. and not stopping, not getting off the boat. So I finished that. And again, a bit like the Amazon, most of the other people were sort of finished and thought, oh, I can't wait to get off of here and go back to normal life. And I was a bit like, oh, hold on, I live here now. Like, this is great. I like this. I just figured it all out. So I got off and I thought we could do so much more with this as well, because a lot of the stories that we were telling through this initiative were about the threats, and they were about the pollution, the plastic pollution, the sound pollution, you know, etc. And you know, obviously those things are really, really important, and we need to take action on them. But I thought, we also need to be telling the stories about what is possible to do and about all of the amazing things that are going on to actually bring back biodiversity and to clean up our seas and to restore the ecosystems. Because I know through my work with Naturemetrics, there are projects all around the coastline that are doing this across seagrass, coral, salt marsh, oyster reefs, etc. And they work. They work, you know, pretty fast and really well, and you can see biodiversity coming back. And actually, so much of the challenge you face now is that people feel hopeless. They feel like there's, you know, there are all of these sort of compounding crises that are coming at us, and what can we actually do? And actually, we've got so many examples of things that you can do, that especially in the biodiversity space, to really make a difference. So being a bit of a glutton for punishment, I thought I'm gonna do this again, and I'm gonna put together my own team, which is all women who work in the fields of nature and climate, and we're going to row around Great Britain, and while we're collecting all the data, we're also going to tell all of the stories of the conservation and restoration projects that are going on, so that we can hopefully just inspire people to get involved and to feel like they can do something different.
That's huge. I mean, again, like, as you said, you know, people spend a month on a boat like this and they will hopefully never get back onto a rowing boat like that. And for you, it turned out to be different, right? You connected the dots once again, and then I'm launching this as a women-run challenge this time. But I want to drop in with you on this very important point that, you know, once you start seeing the world through the eyes of what people are actually doing to create a healthy planet, to work together, to kind of, you know, mirror maybe even the ants in the Amazon in the sense of like the symbiosis with the tree, and how we as humans in our best form maybe are like a keystone species that is symbiotic with other species and symbiotic with the environment. Once you start seeing the world like that, it's kind of really hard to unsee it, right? And it happened in a different way to me through this journey of the podcast the last 5 to 6 years here, interviewing people like yourself, where I'm realizing, wow, there are so many amazing people out there that are creating, you know, everyone's creating a part of the puzzle. Like, everyone's mm-hmm. contributing a puzzle piece or two to this larger puzzle of, you know, a world that actually honors nature, but maybe also honors the progress that our modern world has created, and kind of finds a new way how those two fit together, you know? What are some of your favorite projects out there? I know you're also involved with KELP and the KELP Foundation in the Netherlands. What else are you seeing where you're like, this is just mind-blowing, and, you know, more people need to know about it?
I think what I'm seeing in a general sense is the people who are bringing those different pieces of the puzzle starting to come together, and actually starting to come together quite fast. And it's so important. You know, one of the dangers is that as biodiversity becomes something that people are more aware of throughout businesses and finance and everything, there's a feeling that we've got to figure out how to do all of this from first principles. And it's very easy to forget that, like you said, there's people on the ground everywhere, all over the world, who know their local environments, and they know how to manage it, and they know how to restore it, and how to, you know, how to work with it. But they haven't had the funding to do it at scale, or they haven't had the right incentives to be able to, you know, protect things, because there's been other financial interests that have sort of got in the way. And one of the, you know, there's a danger that we sort of ignore all of that knowledge and try and reinvent wheels that we don't need to. So you've got to tap into that knowledge on the ground, but then you've got to bring the financing. And for me, one of the most exciting things that's happened over the last few years, and I first really became aware of this at COP26 in Glasgow, is the involvement of the finance sector, of the banks, the insurance, insurance industry, the investors, sort of realizing that if they're going to start making claims about their impacts on nature, that their impacts are through their portfolios or through their supply chains or through their, you know, the organizations and the initiatives that they invest in, and that actually they hold this power to be able to through quite small movements of the lever at their end really drive behavior change. You know, they can make it more expensive to do things the wrong way than to do it the right way, and that's huge. And so now we're working in a place where we have, you know, you go to, and this is why I go to things like the COPs, because you get to sit in these small, quite intimate spaces in some of the pavilions with all of these different players that are involved in that sort of systems change. Everyone from like local communities, NGOs, corporates, investors, etc. But we have a challenge around language, because these are sort of groups of people who have no history of working together, and they have no trust really between one another. So as much as the bankers are sitting there going, oh, I don't know if we sort of feel comfortable giving lots of money to these ecologists on the ground who don't look like the sort of people we normally give money to. And the ecologists are sitting there going, well, we really want to do this at scale, but we don't like the money that comes from there with those words and those requirements and all sorts. And so there's this real sort of need to sort of lean in, learn each other's languages, and create. And for me, that's also where the data comes in, because actually the data, if the data is meaningful from the ground level up, yes, you need simple metrics at the top, but if you've got complex data at the beginning, at the bottom, you can simplify it up, and then that data is still meaningful to the people on the ground, and you can start building that as the sort of common language and the thing that they can all coalesce around, and sort of build the trust and accelerate the flows of finance down onto the ground. So I think it's those sort of multi-stakeholder projects, and we're seeing them all over the world, where you've got you're just like joining of dots. That's why, you know, you've said it. I feel like that's what I've said most. The phrase I've used most in the last year is joining of dots, both in time inside our own company and externally. With the Global Biodiversity Framework now, we've got the governments getting involved as well, because 188 governments have signed up to halt and reverse the loss of nature by 2030. I mean, that's unbelievably ambitious, but it's spurring action. And they're thinking, well, how they can't do it all themselves. So they've got to work with the private sector. They've got to work with the conservation initiatives that are going on, et cetera, and find those like double and triple wins where we can sort of all work together. So yeah, there's so much going on right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And it comes back down to, you know, creating these pathways, connecting these dots. And you said it, the currency of that is trust, right? And the trust has been eroded in our capacity and ability to actually be stewards of the natural environment, while also, you know, creating a technology society that, you know, uses the internet to have this conversation, or anyone who's tuning in into this conversation is using the internet to connect to it, right? And so those are maybe paradoxical at first, but, you know, I have this conviction that they belong together in a certain way. Like, we don't have to turn into machines or robots to be future humans. We can kind of take the wisdom of indigenous people and the natural ways and connect them with our modern ways. How does trust happen for you, Kat? How do you experience that? I mean, maybe another way to ask this, like, what is required for you to trust someone in something?
Gosh, a lot of it's about shared experience, I think. You know, when the chips are down, do people do what they need to for one another? And that's very difficult actually to anticipate. It's interesting. I mean, it's something that I've thought about a lot with the rowing challenges, because again, that's all trust and. There's a lot at stake if you get things wrong. So, you know, again, just things like sort of veered slightly off of biodiversity and back onto rowing. But going out and putting yourself in those difficult situations and seeing, you know, the extent to which you've got one another's backs and the rowing boat, it's sort of similar to what we're asking people to do in the nature space now, which is you're all talking, you're all saying lots of things. There's lots of people saying the right sort of things. You got to actually just get on and do it now. Put some skin in the game, get together, try it. And it's not always going to go right to start with. You're going to have to adapt, learn. But the time, there isn't time to sit around and worry about what might go wrong. We've got to put some skin in the game, get in there together. Just build that trust through actually doing things.
Through actually doing things and building that resilience, you know, muscle or muscle memory in a certain way, right? Like, I mean, you bring it back to rowing, but I think it's, I'm not a rower, but I definitely, you know, have participated in my share of team sports in the sense that that's part of it, right? Like when we put ourselves out there, we experience what goes right and what goes wrong, what we're good at and what we're not so good at, what we need the person on our right or our left for, and like what we actually contribute to a team. And so it's interesting that you have these two pivotal experiences of being either in the Amazon or on the boat for a month, where, as you said earlier, many people would maybe give up or be like, oh my God, I just want to go back to convenience. However,
we see it with the startup as well. You know, it's the same journey, right? And it's tough and it's hard, and you know things aren't. I think with a lot of this, the common thing is, you know, things are going to go wrong sometimes. It's not always going to go right because we're at the cutting edge and we're doing new things and we're pushing boundaries. And, you know, so for people to, not everybody's comfortable there. So actually, you've got to find the people who are comfortable there, and push the boundary so you make it more comfortable for those who follow along behind. You know, I think that's part of what it is to be at the leading edge, is establishing the art of the possible, so that it can, you know, the mainstream can follow behind.
Right. But then also, I mean, is life really about being comfortable? I mean, don't get me wrong, I like sitting on the couch every now and then, but like, I think life itself and the natural world, you know, if we scale back all the layers, like how do we get into this situation in the first place? It's because somehow we, you know, as a people, we have this belief system that we are at a fight with nature, right? It's like humanity versus nature. We need to dominate, otherwise we will be killed. And that, you know, I think at this point, many, many people have understood that's just, you know, inherently wrong. We are stewards of nature, and we're in a symbiotic relationship with nature as we are nature, right? And so, when we look at nature through that lens, though, we have to admit that it isn't always convenient, right? Like, yeah, if it rains and it's cold, like, oof, you better get shelter, or you build something, or you help each other, or at least you got like a cardigan or something, right? And so life can be tough, and life can actually force us into resilience. And I think to eradicate that factor in life.
The longer we wait to change, the more we're going to be forced into it.
Exactly.
Because, you know, there isn't a, it's a completely false dichotomy to say it's sort of, you know, the environment or the economy. Like, there is no economy if we don't have a healthy functioning environment. Yeah. There's nothing. Yeah. Like, you know, that's what's been really interesting about all of these big new sort of disclosure frameworks and things that have come out with, you know, TNFD and CSRD and all of the alphabet soup of these new sort of policy frameworks.
Abbreviations.
But they have made, so these are the sort of new mechanisms and frameworks for businesses to have to report on their impacts and dependencies on nature, which is a huge step. And while there's some concern about it just becoming another tick box exercise, but actually for a lot of businesses, what it's made them do is look under the bonnet and go, oh, hold on a second, at the base of our supply chain is like agriculture or forestry or cotton or, you know, some sort of natural raw material that relies on a healthy functioning ecosystem. This isn't just about being compliant and ticking the boxes. This is actually about securing the long-term sustainability of the businesses. And that's driving, you know, genuine action and concern and some really, you know, some really positive signs that, you know, we can do this, we can make the change that we need to. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there's no reason that we have to be in this sort of very depletive relationship with nature. I mean, you look at everything that's happening in the regenerative agriculture space, and there's so much evidence that we can work with nature in a completely different way that doesn't necessarily lead to reduced yields or anything. It gives much greater resilience, much longer term benefits. And so, you know, yes, there's a sort of a dip that you need to help the farmers through, but there are better ways of doing things that will enable us to live the pretty much the lives that we want to. I think that comfort thing is an interesting one, because I have to remind myself all the time that I'm not necessarily representative of most people. And while I quite like being on the leading edge of things and being a bit of a pioneer, and I love being a bit uncomfortable, that's not the same for most people. And it's the same with businesses and any other stakeholder. You know, there's a small group of them that will stick their necks out and don't mind being the trailblazers, but the vast majority want someone to have been there and done it before, and they want to know it's going to be okay, and they need that sort of certain level of comfort to be able to move forward. So, it's not for everyone being on the front edge.
Yeah, and you know, fair enough. I think you're right about that, and that's part of biodiversity, is that within our human species, we all are different. You know. Different in different set points, right? And so maybe you have a larger threshold of resilience to being uncomfortable. But I do think that, you know, whilst comfort and convenience is an achievement of the modern world, it's also, like, you know, to say it really frankly, like, convenience kills, right? Because it doesn't actually create more symbiosis with life. It's the opposite. It goes a different direction, right? And so, like, I think there is a piece or a gold nugget of truth or wisdom there for everyone, actually, as to, like, when we regularly face discomfort, we're actually interfacing with life in a certain way, right? And in a certain way, we all know that, because we know that progress or evolution or, you know, growing happens when we're outside of our comfort zone a little bit.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. I would
follow up question there for you is about purpose. How would you define purpose now that you've, like, you know, kind of, as you said at the very beginning of this conversation, like, it just happened to you more so than you were looking for it.
How would I define purpose? That's a big question. For me, my purpose is always shifting, actually. It's and again, I think this, it's adapting, and it's about finding what's the piece of the puzzle that I bring, and how can I put that together with the other pieces of the puzzle that others bring. So it's about it's always about collaboration for me. It's always about helping to move the dial and move things forwards in the right direction through the particular sort of skill set that I can bring. And I just think we've, you know, the purpose for us all collectively just has to be to create a world in which we can live sustainably within the resources that the planet can provide. Because otherwise there isn't really anything else. And it has to be to maintain a level of optimism within that as well, to really show and focus on, yes, there's always things we can pick holes in. There's always downsides that we can find. There's always risks that we need to be aware of, but actually, we've got to lean into the good things, even when they're small, because you've got to push them forward and encourage them to get bigger. And so anything that I can do, you know, wherever that is, to help sort of amplify or accelerate or add to sort of what's being done somewhere else, join it up with other things, to move forwards together, I would say is overarchingly sort of my purpose.
Yeah, beautifully put. I like the realness about that purpose can be a changing thing, right? And it is, it's kind of a, how do I serve others or like a larger pursuit than myself? I relate to that very much on a personal level. Beautiful, Kat. Thank you so much for your time, for your insights, for sharing a bit about your journey, for inviting us to look deep into Nature Metrics. And you're saying it is the time where these different stakeholders are starting to collaborate and work together. Maybe from an inner drive, maybe from a necessity to do something good for the planet. Like, I mean, it doesn't even matter how or why, right? It's just the time to come together in this way. I know you have lots of travel in front of you. We're going to broadcast this episode within the next couple of days. So is there anything you want to share with the world, any call to action, anything you'd like to ask people, anywhere we'd want people who watch and listen to this to go to after the episode?
Find out what's going on locally to you. Find out what you can get involved in, because there's amazing work going on everywhere, from small scale to large scale, and there are ways to get involved in it. Get to know your local environment, feel part of it, and see what you can do to help restore it and transform it and look after it and live within it in a way that is harmonious.
Yeah, beautiful. I love that call to participation. Thank you so much, Kat. That was a fantastic interview. Thank you.
Thank you so much.